Finance come to order, please. It is 9:03 a.m. on March 23rd, 2012. On our agenda today, we please have some quiet in the room. Thank you. We'll continue deliberation of House Bill 9, but House Bill 64 will not be on today's agenda. We want to make sure we have enough time to. It's my bill, and I've said I had a trend about pushing my bills to the back and make sure other people's bills, but not indefinitely. HCR 16, the constitutional amendment, I want to take that up first. We've had a roundtable discussion on that, but it is a constitutional amendment, as everybody's aware, and wanted to ask Representative Keller to come forward. Notice we have all members here except for Representative Jewell, who I believe will be joining us. So we have a quorum. Everybody have their House Bill, HCR 16 packet. I think it's pretty well known. It's simple in its words, complicated only in its administration. Representative Keller.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, because I know you know the issue in the bill, HGR 16 just puts before the voters a choice of whether or not they want to allow indirect assistance to go to students in the state of Alaska. It's directed at what has been called the Blaine Amendment. Vic Fisher called it a standard feature of the all Western states' constitutions after in a failed attempt to put the Blaine Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. So I'm here more to respond than anything else because I don't want to drag you through a whole lot. The only thing I would say is that this does not institute any programs. It just allows for the state to come up with programs that provide indirect aid to students in Alaska. And it's a vote for the people. Thank you.
Why don't we make the motion to move the bill, and then we'll have the discussion. We'll have the round of that. The constitutional amendment. I don't want to call it just a bill. Yeah, we have not amended it.
Mr. Chairman, I move before the committee the House Joint Resolution Number 1627-LS0024/A.
Will somebody object so we can discuss it if necessary?
Yeah.
Okay. Discussion. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking again at the minutes from the Constitutional Convention. You know, I'm never going to get this. I'll be walking out of here before I learn to do that. And there was an amendment offered there that isn't exactly the same as this, but has the same sense of it, as nearly as I can tell. And the convention, by a count of what looks like about 2-1, voted against it. And I was wondering if the sponsor could just tell me a little bit more about that.
Keller. Yeah, thank you, Representative Dugan. I also have, if the chair of the committee would like to have it for distribution, it's out of Vic Fisher's book, and it speaks directly to that. And it's very, very fascinating.
Sure, why don't you give that to the clerk, and she'll pass it out. Right? A lot of us have read that as well. Read Vic Fisher's book.
What it was after.
Get our hands on the Constitution.
After it was called a standard feature of Western Constitution, somebody made a proposed amendment to include the words "and indirect" in the language that is there. So it'd be a prohibition against providing direct and indirect. And I want to just read from Vic Fisher's statement because it's very fascinating. It's exactly the same vote as we have before us. Proponents of the proposed amendment stressed the importance of protecting the integrity of public education, while the opponents, in this case, what I'm proposing here, the opponents argued for the provision of services to the individual students, if otherwise in keeping with the Constitution. What's fascinating to me is that amendment attempted amendment failed 34 to 19, which is exactly, just as it turns out, just for interest sake, 64%, which is what our current polls, we have two real big polls that have been done in Alaska, and about 64%, well, one of them 55, the other one 64% of Alaskans would approve of a change that would allow vouchers. So it consistent with this HR 60.
And polls are within that. This is a constitutional amendment. You know, we often, this is one that we're not just guided by polls, but rather our values and a lot of other views as well. But the polls, the poll information is useful public information. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've heard from many on both sides of this issue, and so I also want to point out that this just takes it to the voter. This is not put in a plan, but some of the things I didn't think about when I got it, I received some from some parents of special needs children. And there's some students in our schools right now that have needs that really are greater than what our schools can handle. And it's to no fault of their own. They just need more. And this bill, that's one of the things that it would help with. It would allow those special needs children to go out and go possibly to a private school to be able to meet those needs better than what a public school has right now, and that's not a criticism, but you know I don't want to see this because what I had heard in a lot of the testimony, even that we took, that this is a shot at the public schools, and it's not. It's really allowing, no matter how much money you make, that you have an option of what to do with your children based on their needs, and that's the way I see it. The sad thing is the details are going to be in what comes in if this passes, and that's going to be what parameters is the department going to put around it. How would you qualify as a school to be able to get a voucher? But that's not what – this is a public discussion is where it does right now. Does every parent have the right or have some money to go to be able to put their children in a setting that they think is the best for them, no matter what they can currently afford? A lot of single parents out there doing the best they can. They can't just have no option of sending their children anywhere but the public schools. So I think it's time for the discussion, up or down. I think it will be an interesting discussion. Either direction, whether it passes or fails, but I think we're in a time right now. I'm in favor of this and be watching very closely if it passes, what kind of regulations get done at that point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit about the constitutional history. If you look at people across the spectrum at the Constitutional Convention, whether it was Delegate Coghill or Delegate Rivers, they said the system of education we wanted to set up in the state was one of free public education. Representative Coghill said, if I can just read a little bit, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
That I believe the way our government was set up 175 years ago, that the founders felt that public education was necessary to bring about a form of educating the whole child for the civic benefit through the division of point of some of the home taking a certain part of the child, the church taking a certain part of his education, and the government or state through public schools taking the other part. I feel that the intent of public education is primarily a state function and does not belong to any private or any one particular group. And then Delegate Rivers, or Delegate Metcalf, said that there are 16 states
that... For record, which Rivers was that?
I'm sorry, Delegate Metcalf. I think there was only one. Well,
there were two rivers, though.
Yeah, that's why I skipped the rivers. I think you're right, yeah.
And then there was Mickey Rivers, but he played for the Angels.
Yeah. You got that in.
Please, proceed.
And I don't know what Mickey Rivers' views were on...
They're probably not very intelligible, given some of the interviews I've heard from them.
Delegate Metcalf said there are 16 states that have sections in their constitution preventing public tax dollars from being spent for private schools in any way, shape, or form. The Constitution was drawn in 1945, which some of you may have read. It says that no money shall ever be taken from the public treasury, directly or indirectly, in aid of any church, sector, denomination, or religion, or in aid of any priest, preacher, minister, or teacher thereof as such. And he goes on. And I'm also a firm believer in the complete separation of church and state, especially with the use of state money and state property. The delegates chose not to fund private schools. And I think there was a reason for that. Once you have state funding of private schools, you then develop factions within the legislature. You develop those factions who believe that private school funding is very important, and they will want to drag the state money towards what they believe in, and I'd understand that. And there are those who believe in public education. But in the end, we will lose support for funding for public education because there will be a rift in the legislature between those who are trying to drag scarce state dollars towards the kind of school that they believe in the most. And I can't fault people for their different views on education. But the good thing about having a public education system is that it keeps us all in the same boat. And that boat is aimed at having the best public schools possible. That boat develops many, many leaks in it once legislators start saying, no, we should use the money for private education. And so I think the net result will be a worse public education system. It'll be an underfunded public education system. That's my concern about this amendment. I have no problem with people going to private school. Many private schools offer scholarships. And this state has done a phenomenal job for the size of the state and the cost in the state of offering alternative schools to people within the public education system. We have boarding schools that are publicly funded if people don't have the education that their parents want in their community. We have charter schools in our bigger communities so that if parents believe in homeschooling or charter schools run by parents or other forms of charter school, like there's a native charter school in Anchorage, we have many, many options to traditional public education in our bigger cities. So between the boarding schools we have across the state to get people a broader education than they can get in their if they live in a tiny community, to the charter schools we have in urban Alaska, I think we're doing a good job. And as much as we all and we're all guilty, or maybe not guilty, we've all done it. As much as we've all made the point that public education has not performed to the standards we want it to, it's been improving. Graduation rates are going up. Proficiency scores are going up. Because through the mid-2000s to the late-2000s, we put a good amount of money into schools. We adjusted the formula that I felt was discriminating against rural Alaska. Many of us felt was discriminating against rural Alaska. When that changed and we gave them parity in funding, that helped. When we started giving schools parity in funding for special education, that helped. As Representative Thomas has said, when we started giving schools a lot of money so they could help pay for their TERS debts, that helped. And in those 5 years that we did those things, graduation rates went up. Achievement went up. We're on the right trajectory. And I don't want to reverse that. And I think that will be reversed if we start diverting public funds to private schools and we start splitting this legislature between those who want to fund private schools more liberally than they want to fund public schools or those on the other side. So I think in the end, this is not a good bill in terms of increasing achievement among those in public education.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Representative Jewell?
Thank you. I'll
anybody else get in the queue?
Comments, Mr. Chairman. Just keep my comments short, I think, just like me. You know, when I started in this business, I used to be three things. Tall, dark, and handsome. Well, two out of three ain't bad. I can't believe I just said that. All right, here we go. We're on a constitutional amendment. At least hopefully inside now it's as bright as it is on the outside. Private schools, you know, I had the privilege of going to a Catholic boarding school. And for my last 3 years of high school, and had to pay my way. I couldn't go home because we didn't have enough money in the house to get me a ticket home, so I stayed and I worked because it cost me money to go to school. I didn't know the difference between public and private then. I just know that my grandfather, who was a 37-year career teacher, allowed me to go, and I wasn't even Catholic. And in hindsight, I probably got the best education that I could have gotten. And I get a little frustrated sometimes when I hear the delineation or the separation of church and state, because sometimes I think our freedoms have become so far-reaching that we forget or don't even allow the things that are important to individuals to even enter a classroom and in our society in public. And sometimes it just frustrates me to no end that we've come that far in pushing freedom and liberty that in a classroom, you have to have a moment of silence to substitute for prayer. Now, I understand respecting everybody's rights and responsibilities, but what about respecting everybody else's? And having said all of that, I understand the opportunities that might be there for this kind of a situation. What I haven't seen before this goes to the floor is the rest of the information. How many students are going to be counted in a base student allocation? What's this going to mean in terms of additional funds? What's this going to mean in terms of additional transportation costs? Where are those figures? Because I understand that people have an issue with and want us to spend money on education, but and maybe $100 million and much money when we start talking about billions, but looking forward. And then there's other issues, and I guess that gets taken care of in statutes. But in terms of just the general question, those are questions that are left in my mind that I don't think I've really seen in the information that has been forwarded to us. But yet I understand the opportunities that one could take advantage of should we go in this direction. So even though I'm a beneficiary of a public school on education, private school education, and I'm still I don't mind this bill going to the floor. I think we need to have that kind of debate. I think it'd be good for us. But at the end of the day, I'm going to have to be convinced that it's the right thing to do.
Thank you, Representative Jewell. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a somewhat of a mixed product here. I spent my first 8 years at St. Joseph's Catholic School, and it was supported by the congregation. There were 7 of us in our family, and we certainly couldn't afford a private school. And there was lots of kids in our class at that same way, and that was back in the 60s, and so times were a little bit different. And I got into a public school for high school, and boy, was that a change. You know, we had different classes. Instead of having the same teacher all day long, you know, they stood on you. But what happened in that Catholic school? You know, we had maybe 45 minutes at the most per day where they taught a religious study. The rest of the day was math, history, science, English, and those were just your basic courses. And it was a great education for me. You know, what we were covering at high school in the senior class, we'd already covered it by 7th and 8th grade in Catholic school in my first 8th grade. You know, so I was pretty well prepared when I went to high school and did pretty well there. Honor roll, even though I probably didn't deserve it, but it came pretty easy with me. And then when we had kids, we started in Big Lake School and a public school, and my wife convinced me after a couple of years to homeschool our kids, so we did that for 10 and 11 years. So we had a pretty good taste of that program. Kind of what helped convince me into becoming a legislator, some of the changes that they were trying to require. And so I've had a pretty well-versed education on there. I got the privilege of chairing the Education Committee my first 2 years in the legislature, thanks to the co-chair helping me get that position. And when I look at this and see how is it going to affect Alaska's educational system, you know, and I look at Alaska's education system as by far, it's a system that is not a one-size-fits-all. When you look at schools have an ADM of 10 in small villages, a minimum, you know, class size, where we still keep those schools open, where the cost per student could be $40,000 or $50,000 a year, to some of the largest schools in the districts where there are 1,400, 1,500 kids in some of those schools in the middle of a town. You know, we have regional learning centers, which I think are fantastic, and probably part of Alaska's future and expanded future. How would it affect if there was going to be some funding that goes into a Catholic school or a private school? Would it be just the base amount, so $5,700 or somewhere in there is where it is right now? Not including local contributions, federal contributions, all the other things that are part of the student funding formula as far as the state's concerned, you know, the base student. With correspondence programs, it was 80% of the base. So about $4,400, no matter where you lived in the state, your total cost to education in the state is about $4,400, 80% of the base. Does not include local contributions or any of the federal or any of the other multipliers that go into the student funding formula, the five steps and the multipliers that go through that. If we were to fund private education, or what this would describe as private education, do they get just the state base? And these are giving me students that are, we're not going to grow a bunch of more students in Alaska. We're going to take students that are probably in public education, may move over to a St. Joseph Catholic school. They're going to, you know, have less burden or impact. We hear about the overcrowding in the schools right now, but most schools are trying to grow because it comes with more money, and that's a little more complicating factor. Schools want more kids so they can get more money, but then they have more kids in the classroom to try and deal with. I think this is going to have the opportunity to move some of those kids out of the public schools into some private schools if their parents so choose. Do we go back to that local control? I'm a local control person. I think that Alaska is not a one-size-fits-all. But this puts it more into the hands of the parent instead of the hands of government. It allows more opportunities. Alaska is not a one-size-fits-all. It's what I keep coming back to. There's so many different opportunities. And Alaska leads the nation in correspondence programs. About 10% of our students are correspondent. Another three independent. That they don't take any state money, and they're independent. They don't have a student ID number. They're on their own, and Alaska is one of the few states that allows that. I think that giving parents a choice of how they want to raise their students and the type of school that they should go through is what we should be trying to do. I really support that. I support this resolution because it gives parents that choice. Is it going to affect other schools? How they're going to affect that? Well, we've got a lot of issues facing our school system right now, and we're all trying to our best to try and work through that. The chairs, co-chairs are committed next week to spend a tremendous amount of time trying to figure out how to do that, I believe. And I think this is a good opportunity, again, for parent choice. You know, we go back to what's best for the kids. I don't care if we're talking to a teacher from NEA, or the school boards, it comes down to the discussion is, it's what's best for the kids. Well, that should be the parents' choice, not government's choice. And that's why I support this resolution. Thank you,
Representative Newman. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Representative Keller first brought this to the committee, sat in that chair and brought this to for us, I felt that I had been in a defining moment, because many years ago, Mike Dugan, father of Mike, delegate to the state to the Constitutional Convention, sat me down and told me why this was a no. he had this dialogue with me, and we had it a few times amongst other issues. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, this is interesting. I mean, I was a lot younger then, and, you know, Jim had raised the children. He was a Catholic, very big activist in the church and Monroe, the school. And there was always a disconnect for me. It's like I couldn't figure it out. But he told me about the process on the floor that he had, the conversations they had on the side, how this statement evolved, where the state can give direct, indirect support for non-public schools, how his dialogue with Delegate Coghill on one side, group of people on the other side, and mostly it was the process questions that he was explaining to me. But one of the things that hasn't been explored, he talked about occasionally, and Representative Dugan might have a different story, because I said to him the other day, when we first heard this, just walking in the hall, I said, your father schooled me on this. He said, me too. I'm sure he had many more opportunities, and I don't know if there's going to be a contradiction here, but there was a side of it that he was concerned about. Once you have public money in a private school, in a church, you have, inevitably, the hands follow. The control issues follow. And he wanted no part of that. He says, my church is separate from the government, and all aspects of that should be clearly divided. There needs to be a clear line. You know, he paid for his kids to go to school out of his pocket. I know he's a deeply religious guy. I had phenomenal respect for him. But that dialogue was there. Parents have choices now. It's just who pays for them. I went to Hebrew school for 3 years. My parents paid for that. I was too young. I didn't understand what it was all about. But the choices are there. But when money follows, control follows. And budget issues follow. And that's very problematic. You know, so they reached a compromise in the convention. I mean, we look up when we talk about the delegates and the Constitution and those proceedings, and we have lots of copies of the dialogue at the convention here. But I feel honored to have been spoken to by a delegate who would appear to be on the other side of this issue than I am, to explain to me why this was a no. And the gentleman that spoke online from the East Coast, you know, he was talking about political theory. This is on-the-ground stuff. I am here. The delegate told me this. This is what happened. This is what happened when it wasn't being recorded. This is what happened on the side conversations. And this is the reasoning. I was just amazed. And I, you know, it was all kind of an academic exercise until this committee heard this for the first day. So for many reasons, and for nothing less than honoring the wishes of the delegates, I'm in favor of this. Thank you.
Is there anybody else? Anybody? Before I get to anyone, I'll just take just a 30-second blast. Let Representative Thomas close out. I'm going to vote to move it out, and I'm inclined to vote for it. I've always had an asterisk on my voucher support, and it's been the same reticence that was previously referenced, and that's we have school systems at work, and government has this way of mucking things up, and that's been the avowed agenda. If you're going to do this, you're going to take every single one of our regulations and everything else that bungles us up in our public school system, and I almost hate to risk ruining something that is working as an alternative, but this is one that I think I've come around to supporting it. Philosophically, I like school choice, but it's always been a real problem for me. Government has this real tendency, if it's not broke, we're going to fix it till it is. And we have a pretty good private alternative, and that is one of my major hanging points. But I think I can get over that. Mr. Co-Chair, before we go, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a decision that should not be taken lightly, even in this committee. We can say, well, all we did was pass it along. But the fact of the matter is that even if you put no rec on this, passing along gives people some information about what the course of the debate is going to be from here on. So I'm not going to be voting for it. And I'm not going to be voting for it not just because my father told me I shouldn't, and not because he was strong, I guess I would say, both in his support of private schools, where I went to school for 16 out of the 18 years I was in the educational institution, I guess I would call it. I'm sure that my teachers might have had a different description of it, but because the idea that we should start cutting people up according to their religious beliefs were just practically anathema to him. He didn't think that the civil institutions should be using religion to make decisions, that there should be a clear line between the one and the other. And the actual wording of the constitutional statement on education says that no money shall be paid from public schools for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. That couldn't be any clearer. So, in addition to the damage that it will inevitably do to the educational system were we to pass this and start doling out money according to people's religious beliefs or their economic situations or any other way, is just inevitable if we start doing down this road. And I don't agree with the vice chairman. The fact of the matter is that in terms of, sorry, the co-chair.
Me?
No, yeah, you, sorry.
Poor Anna.
You got promoted,
yeah. Never mind. But I don't agree with that statement. I do not agree that somehow the obvious failures of the educational system in some cases should be the reason for us to contemplate the complete dismantling of it. And that's what we're doing here. Because what's going to happen is that people in the rich districts are going to school up and use their money to improve their educational system. And the people with the poor districts are, in the case of the Bush, not enough to do that. And in the case of the remaining students, are going to have to deal with handicaps, social handicaps, economic handicaps, other handicaps, that the rich students aren't going to have to. So there is no way that I can think of at the moment, and I got to tell you, I thought about this a lot because of my direct connection to this question, and there is no way I can support this. You know, you're always thinking, well, you know, I forget who it was who said, I'm a man of principle, and my first principle is flexibility.
Former Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen of Illinois. He was from Pekin, Illinois.
And I like to think that I'm like that when I sit at this table and when I push the button on the floor. But I have to admit, I'm inflexible on this point. And I'm going to vote not to send it out of here because I don't see any sense of inflaming the passions of people on this question, which are going to arise, getting in a situation where if, in fact, this passes and there is some sort of election on this, that it will get worse, and we will have an outcome not just that's unknowable, not just in terms of how the election will turn out, but is unknowable in the case of if the proponents of this win, what's going to happen? You know, we're familiar with the flaws of the current educational system, but I have to tell you that they're not going to be anything like the fight that's going to happen when this baby goes to an election. And it's going to be completely unknowable of if that election turns out to basically strip the money from the educational system and hand it out in unequal ways. We just aren't. We don't know what's going to happen. And for, therefore, I'm going to vote for this.
I'll just interject. I just want the record just look at what I actually said, not what people think I said or otherwise. And that's, I'm pretty usually pretty clear in my, and I'll let my own statement set, not how they're characterized. And secondly, I think I started this whole debate by saying, as you may remember, Representative Dugan, this is not like any other measure. There will be no pressure. This is not one that we should rush the send to the floor. If you don't, there would no pressure to let the vote occur. It's a constitutional amendment. I think I stated that emphatically on several occasions that this is a constitutional amendment, and that's part of the process of not even letting it get off the ground if you don't support it. So I could have not have been more emphatic at several junctures of the early parts of this debate. So I hope nobody feels pressured to just force a vote. This is part of the process, and it's a reflection of your position. I'm only reemphasizing that because I said it several times, and I don't want anybody to feel that there's any pressure. This is a constitutional amendment, and I will only reemphasize it, even though I've said it probably two or three times previously, because it is a serious issue. It is a constitutional amendment, and that's everyone's a free agent on this.
Mr. Chairman, if I mischaracterized your statements in my zeal, I apologize.
That's okay. I'm glad there's passion on this issue. And in closing, Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I had plenty of time to look at the Constitution, and I noticed that of the writers, there were only 8 that were born in Alaska out of 55. You know, so who has more passion than people born and raised in Alaska, I would say. And the other thing in here, it's been amended. This is not the first time there's going to be an attempt to amend the Constitution. And it's our ordained right, our right to change the Constitution if we think that something's wrong or flawed. We may fail, but this is one that I truly believe people should have the option to vote on. I went home during the break, and I called my older uncles who are, you know, 70, 80 years old, the big aunties, and asked them, about this debate, right? I call them. That's what you call them.
Okay. I can't get away with that in my house.
Well, that's because they're older, so they always. Anyway. Jeez.
Okay. I'm sorry.
And so I says, what do you think the argument was when they were going to let the government schools, let the Alaska Natives loose from the Native government schools to go to public schools? And they're saying the same thing, because some of them were watching the argument. Education in Alaska, the system's going to fall apart. If we let public schools and let them go into the school of choice, it's going to destroy the system. If you let Alaska Natives come to public schools, it's going to destroy them. And we were giggling because they probably were right. Those arguments went on and people heard them. Mr. Speaker, Co-Chair, sitting here looking and I'm saying, well, we send our children to get the best education, and I'm looking at, I wasn't a big proponent of this thing at first, but as I started looking at my own children and the education that they received in the 12 years that they went to school. One was stellar, the next one was weaker, and the other one was even weaker yet. And so what's wrong with me now? I'm not going to be a parent, but Representative Costello letting her have the best education she thinks is right for her children. Other people down the street, we read a survey the other day that the people who dropped out of school said there's nothing better than a good education. I think those are the people who are going to come here and say, give us a better education than what we got. Give us the choice. Give us the option, you know, to go. Maybe they won't. Nothing wrong with Christian school, church school. My grandma raised me. I was in church 3 days a week, maybe four, plus sitting in front of the radio listening to Walter Soboloff. So, you know, my grandmother was very religious, and I don't think it hurt me any.
That's another debate.
I did tell people I did learn to pray when I was in Vietnam. That helped, you know. Maybe that's why I'm home. But so, you know, I'm just saying, I'm going to vote to move this out and probably vote for it on the floor and give the parents. There's one thing growing up that I know the Alaska Native people believe in is a strong, good education for their children. And that is probably why AFN passed the resolution supporting HJR 16 here. And I was at the convention, and that's what it was. It was all about education. You know, and then it says, you know, you can read the resolutions all in your packet. And they called, and this is passed by the delegates, what is it, 4,000 or 5,000, unanimously at the convention, and it was submitted by the AFN Board of Directors. Why? Because they want stellar, not an education, but a stellar education for their children and their grandchildren. And I'm not going to go into it. Maybe they see something. Maybe the system today is flawed. I think I got a good education, but it was different times. I think most of us in here, you know. So, Mr. Coach, I'm going to vote to move it out of here. Let the people decide. Every time we want to do something, let the people decide. I think to stifle the voice of the people this time is absolutely wrong. I think I give them a chance to vote. I was looking at how many times the Constitution has tried to be amended, and it failed. Some good ideas failed, and it's all in the back packet here. So this is an idea. Let them vote on it. If it fails, it fails. It won't be the first time. But I believe we've got to give them the best education we can and let them go out and look. I don't have a homeschool or a charter school or a Christian school in my hometown, so maybe they'll stay there, but who knows. I know that when I was growing up, a lot of the kids whose parents had money sent them to Sheldon Jackson. That was a high school. You know, didn't have grade school there. And the other kids, you know, went to Mount Edgecombe that didn't have school. So anyway, Mr. Coach, I'll vote to move this thing out and listen to the debate on the floor. And if you get involved, I will. A and B convention, I mean, gold medal. This is like a convention going on down here right now. But if you went down there, they would all vote for a good education plan. And some people say vote no and vote yes. It'll be tossed around. But I think I'm going to vote what I think is right for the children. Let the parents decide. Thank you.
Well, if you can get through the next step for this, if this gets through, we may hear this on the floor, Representative. We'll go ahead and call the roll.
No.
Representative Jewell?
Yes.
Representative Newman?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Costello?
Yes.
Representative Dugan?
No.
Representative Edgman?
Yes.
Representative Fairclough?
Yes.
Representative Guerra?
No.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Thomas?
Yes.
Clerk, please announce the roll.
8 yay, 3 nay.
So the bill advances out of committee. We'll take about a 2 minute at ease, so inside the report and let the next bill get prepared. Hopefully get it done in 40 minutes.
Thank you.
open for questions, not for comments.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Larry Persley, Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Projects, calling in today from Washington. Certainly, I would not presume as a federal official to tell state government what to do or comment on legislation before you specific provisions of
why would you want to break the trend?
Right. I thought I'd see if anyone caught the subtlety of that.
Or was listening.
Please proceed.
All right. I did prepare some notes. I guess I thought I, without stepping into the exact provisions of HB 9, I could, if the committee would want to hear, I have about 8 or 9 minutes I could give you kind of on current market conditions in Asia and lower 48, what's going on with project financing of LNG export projects from the U.S.
Sure, I figured you'd find a way to make this ecumenical, and I didn't expect any difference. So why don't you go ahead and give us useful information.
Okay. Sure. So what I thought I would do, Mr. Chairman, is just kind of run people through kind of what's going on with markets, project financing, specifically looking at U.S. LNG exports and the potential for that, whether LNG prices will stay high in Asia, whether Alaska can compete on price, and what's going on with the U.S. market, will it ever recover? Of all the projects that are proposed in the lower 48 to export U.S. LNG, Cheniere Energy, which has a proposed project at Sabine Pass, Louisiana, is the only one that has Department of Energy approval to export U.S. gas to non-free trade nations, China and Japan being the two that everyone's looking at. 8 other applications are pending while the Department of Energy awaits a study this year on natural gas exports, how it would affect the U.S. gross domestic product, how it would affect economy, consumer prices, and such. They want to look cumulatively at all those projects, not just individually. But meanwhile, like I say, Sabine Pass, Cheniere Energy does have the DOE export approval. They do not yet have their Federal Energy Regulatory Commission certificate, though FERC is expected to grant that shortly. They hope to start construction this year. The history on the Cheniere plant is interesting. They opened as an LNG import terminal back in 2008, 2009, when the whole world thought the U.S. was going to be short of natural gas. They actually have the capacity there to take in and distribute 4 billion cubic feet a day. That is a huge import terminal. But as we know, the market changed, the world changed. The U.S. was not buying natural gas. The company's debt was downgraded to junk. There was question whether they could even service that debt. They looked across the Pacific, saw higher prices in Asia for LNG, and they decided the smart thing to do is turn that facility around, turn it into a dual-use project by adding liquefaction and shipping to the receiving and regasification capabilities they already have. But as we've learned in Alaska over the last 40 years with natural gas, if you don't have customers, you don't have a project. They succeeded there. They signed up 4 customers for about 2 billion cubic feet a day of capacity. And the 4 customers are BG Group, or British Gas Group, a global LNG marketer, GAIL India, which is a major gas utility in India, Korea Gas Corporation, and a company called Gas Natural Fenosa, which is Spain's largest gas and power utility. All 4 of those buyers have signed 20-year contracts. The first 2 production trains at Sabine Pass are to go in operation if all goes on schedule by 2016, the second 2 trains by 2017. All 4 of those companies have signed the equivalent of shipper pay, take-or-pay contracts. In this case, it's really more appropriate to call it use-or-pay. They've all agreed to pay, by contract, somewhere between $2.25 and $3 per million BTU. Most of it is actually at $3. They're going to pay that to reserve liquefaction capacity at the plant, and they're going to pay that bill for 20 years, even if they don't use it. Those 4 contracts represent about $45 billion in binding commitments over the 20 years. Cheniere's got to the end of this year or middle of next year, depending on the contract, to get its first certificate, its financing, get everything in line, or they can bail out on that contract. So in addition to that, and that's the only way Cheniere can get financing, is contracts for someone who's going to produce the revenue, pay off the debt. In addition to that liquefaction charge, the contracts call for the customers to buy gas based on Henry Hub, on U.S. lower 48 gas prices, plus a 15% upcharge for the gas that's going to be consumed during liquefaction. What that means is you take the liquefaction charge, take the price of gas, take the cost of a tanker going through the Panama Canal into Asia. When gas is at $3 at Henry Hub, that means you can land that gas as LNG in Asia for $9. If you have $6 gas in the lower 48, you'd have about a $12 landed cost for everything to get it there. I guess that's just to illustrate the competition out there, what it's going at. Even though Asia prices historically, LNG prices have been tied to global oil prices, this first contract out of Louisiana is tied to U.S. natural gas prices. Now, Cheniere then, with those customer contracts in hand, was able to go get financing. They're looking at about $10 billion to build the liquefaction plant and other improvements. They have lined up $2 billion in private equity financing from a private equity firm called Blackstone. They're going to get the rest by issuing debt. They're going to be Blackstone on its $2 billion investment. During construction, will be accruing interest at about 17%. Construction financing is pretty heavy for Cheniere at this. So I guess that one looks like it's going to go ahead. You've got about eight others that are waiting to see if they're going to go ahead, a few more out of British Columbia. Truth is, you're not going to get 12 export projects. The market's going to decide the ones that get contracts and get financing, those are the ones that will get built. Looking at the Asian market in general, just a little bit more in terms of prices, what's going on. Australia has eight LNG export projects under development. Even the ministry says, hey, when those eight are done, we're going to take a rest for a while. That's about $180 billion worth of projects under development in Australia. It will quadruple the country's export capacity to more than 10 billion cubic feet a day by 2017, which means they would overtake Qatar as the world's leader. Those two, Qatar and Australia, you're looking at about 21 billion cubic feet a day of export capacity. From perspective, in 2010, about 29 billion cubic feet of LNG on average day moved around. There's also expansions, new projects, developments underway in Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, Angola, Russia. In Mozambique, producers Anadarko and partners and ENI and partners have announced discoveries totaling 60 trillion cubic feet. They're looking toward Asia. So that's the competition there. But on the other hand, as we know, boy, the price is really good right now in Asia. Current spot market prices for April delivery to Asia this week are nudging back towards $16 per million BTU. But the market's waiting. The Japanese federal government is expected sometime this spring to decide whether they're going to restart some of the nuclear plants or not. And what happens there really could affect prices long-term in Japan. Meanwhile, the high cost of energy in Japan, just as we know in Alaska, is starting to affect behavior, and utilities are pushing back. They're looking for a way to cut their costs. The executive director of Tokyo Gas Company today was quoted as saying, cutting raw material costs is one of the major goals. Tokyo Gas has signed a long-term contract to buy LNG from a BG Group project in Australia that's going to turn coal bed methane into liquefied natural gas. And this Tokyo Gas executive was quoted as saying they're paying significantly lower prices for that coal bed methane, and they want to try to do more of that. There's also pushback in China and India. China and India are different from the United States, certainly, that both governments there set the price for natural gas in their country. The Chinese government, across most of the country, sets the price at about $5. And that was okay for years until importers started paying two or three times that. So the Chinese government is testing out, just in two provinces so far, letting the cap raise to $12 per million BTU. Their hope is that will spur increased domestic production because they'd rather pay themselves than buy it. China produces about 80% of the gas it needs. Last year, it imported about 3 billion cubic feet a day of gas, split roughly 50-50 between LNG and pipeline gas from Turkmenistan. Just to give you an idea on prices, in January of this year, China buyers paid an average of about $10 per million BTU for pipeline gas. And for LNG, it ranged anywhere from $3.5 to $18 per million BTU. Low end was gas they were taking on old contracts. They signed at good prices. The expensive stuff was on today's higher prices. India, like I said, also sets the price of gas in that country, and they're instituting pricing reform to try to spur domestic production. So long-term, Asia, you know, will there be more domestic production of India and China? How will the markets react to higher prices? You know, back in the U.S., just to close, we know gas prices are horrendous here. 10-year lows, it's ugly, it's getting worse. Storage capacity could run out of it later this year. Most industry believers, industry observers believe eventually supply and demand will come back in balance. It's the law of economics. You've got different forecasts out there. Shell sees gas $6 long-term in the U.S. Anadarko's CEO recently said he expects gas in the U.S. to be $5 to $7 by 2016. Goldman Sachs sees a price recovery starting in 2013. Deloitte predicts second half of this decade gas will be $6.50, but those are just projections, and you know, it certainly makes sense for any producer of oil and gas in Alaska to look at all markets, Asia and the U.S., but the private money is going to pick the one that gets the investment and gets built. But I think we also need to accept in closing the risk is so great on Alaska, the time to build the timeline, it takes so many years, the cost, the volatility of the markets, our distance from markets, that if we're going to ever get a sizable gas project in Alaska, the state's going to have to get involved somewhere or another to help with that risk. Anyway, those were my comments on markets, but I'm certainly happy to answer any questions or take any abuse on behalf of the federal government.
Questions for Mr. Persley. Representative Guerra, without even looking, I'm just going to get it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing Mr. Persley to add some perspective. Larry, just so people understand, spot market sales, those tend to be at a higher price than long-term sales. Is that correct?
They have been of late. It often will depend if you've got a cargo and you'd like to send it somewhere. There's great demand for it that day. You can command a premium price. Sometimes you gamble. You got a cargo. No one particularly needs it. You got to cut your price a little bit. But generally, spot is you're paying a premium. You don't have it under contract. You got to pay what you're going to have to that day to get that gas.
And through the chair. And I'm just going to try and combine two questions, and I want to make it quicker.
Just go and proceed talking to Mr. Persley. We'll just place out.
And my understanding is we can't really run a pipeline on spot market prices. We can't keep shutting it down and opening it up and shutting it down. Is that a fair assumption, or can you elaborate?
A pipeline, you can actually vary the flow. The liquefaction plant is the problem. They just don't run well, stop and go. You've got to get financing, you've got to know you have a revenue stream, as Chenier did. So it's not just financing, it's operations. A liquefaction plant just doesn't work well. If it's going today, close a week, open a month, close down again.
Okay.
So you do need long-term contracts to get financing information allowed.
Thank you. And then, Larry, you mentioned the Chenier plant was, tied to Henry Hub, but aiming at a price of $9 to $12. Is that accurate, and is that maybe a fair benchmark for what these other United States export potential facilities might be trying to sell their gas for?
Well, Representative Garrett, it's interesting. Chenier is not a producer. They're just, it's like running a toll road. They don't care what the price of gas is. They're just going to make their money as it moves through their plant. But given the pricing structure of those deals, it looks like for $3 U.S. gas, it can be delivered in Japan at about $9, and Chenier even admits that. It will be interesting to see if the Department of Energy allows another export project, and if they can get contracts now, and the whole industry is looking at this, is this the new benchmark? Will people want gas priced to Henry Hub, which is lower today than oil prices?
Mr. Persley, can we assume that, I mean, let's say some of these other eight American export facilities that are trying to get a permit send gas out, can we assume a similar price given what the Henry Hub price is in the lower 48 for their export projects?
Well, my belief would be that if you're going to build an export plant or in the U.S., in Texas, Louisiana, you're going to have to compete on Cheniere's pricing structure, that they set that benchmark. Now, if you're a producer, it might be different. These were not U.S. producers that took capacity in this plant. If you're a producer and you're moving your own gas, it's going to be different. You know, you'll sell it certainly for as much as you can, but most people, certainly with the current oversupply in the U.S., you have a lot of producers would be happy to sell the gas almost at any price these days. But there is a lot of uncertainty until people see a second round of contracts coming out of the U.S., how it's going to be priced. And who's going to be signing them?
And Mr. Persley, let me ask you about, I know you've read the ASAP project plan report that has their price estimates in it, and I'm just trying to get a sense of how competitive gas through this plant might be on the Asian market. on page 310, they list the for a 500 MCF line, the tariff to Big Lake to being $7.75, and I just want to make sure my additions on top of that make sense. On top of the $7.75, I think they assume $2 for the cost of gas. Does that sound right to you?
That's my recollection, too, but it's been a while since I've read this.
Okay, and then to get from Big Lake to Nikiski or some other Tidewater facility, that's probably another $2 in local gas distribution costs. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, Representative, I don't think it'd be that much on the NSTAR system, but it's nothing I've ever priced out.
Okay. Do you have a better number, or do we know?
I'm sure there's someone in the room who provides a better number, or certainly
okay.
NSTAR, someone could provide it to you. Because you're right, unless you had a liquefaction plant there, you'd have to move it by pipe to Tidewater.
Okay, and then we're going to have to condition the gas at a liquefaction plant. Can you give us a rough estimate of what that might add to the cost?
It is very hard to estimate. We know what Cheniere is charging at their plant. That's a pretty cost-effective plant because they've already got the docks and the storage tanks built. It's also a big project at 2 billion cubic feet. Your liquefaction costs would depend on how big the plant is, how much infrastructure you've got to build with it and pay for through that liquefaction as opposed to having something you can already use. I believe when Wood Mackenzie did its study for the Alaska Gas Mine Port Authority last year of a very large liquefaction plant at Valdez, one that would be capable of sending out 2.7 billion cubic feet a day. I believe Wood Mackenzie estimated liquefaction costs at around $4 per million BTU, but they also acknowledged that was a real pull it out of the clouds number and a very expensive plant. I guess what it costs, any company that wants to get into the LNG business out of Alaska is going to look at the cost, size the project to what the market is willing to pay, and if the liquefaction costs are too high that make them uncompetitive in the market, they're going to have to figure out a way to get them down.
All right. And then
Representative Thomas has something on the point here.
Yeah, but thank you. Larry, Representative Thomas here. Question in regards, all we're talking about is the increased cost to the treating the gas. Now, I know that we're sitting right in the middle of the transportation corridor, and wouldn't it be cheaper for people to come here to Alaska than to go to B.C. or Mexico or anywhere else in the U.S. to get gas if you're going to the Mideast or the Far East? I mean, transportation, we're looking at price of oil anymore. You can save half your shipping costs rather than just keep adding on the gas plant. I'm thinking shipping costs got to be a pretty good attraction also, because you can move twice as much gas then. What about that?
Sure, Representative Thomas, you're right. Tanker charges from Tidewater in Alaska to Japan are going to be significantly less than from Louisiana or Texas to Japan, even with the expanded Panama Canal open in 2014. You know, I've seen estimates the tanker charge might be $1.50, $2 less per million BTU. But on the other hand, those shippers, whatever you want to call them, producers, shippers in the Gulf Coast have got the gas at Tidewater. You're going to have to pay several dollars per million BTU to move the gas from Prudhoe Bay to Tidewater in Alaska, and that's going to, I don't know if I'd say wipe out or negate. Yeah, it's pretty much going to take care of, wipe out the savings you had on a shorter tanker run. So it's from Prudhoe to port in Tidewater plus the tanker charge versus what they have for tanker charge and liquefaction costs, and that's what we're going to have to compete on from Alaska.
And that's my point. Thank you.
Back to Ripon and Gary. And we've got about 10 more minutes till session starts. So,
And just the tanker cost, Larry, so I can just have all the components of the cost to get the gas to Asia. What's an estimate, a fair estimate for tanker costs to get gas to Asia?
I've seen estimates for tanker charges from Alaska to Asia, $1, even a little bit less per million BTU. There are not any that our office produced, but I have seen those. 90 cents. You're right. Tanker charges, no question, they're cheaper, but then you got to add in the pipe cost getting it down from North Slope.
So, Larry, I'm just doing the math, and obviously HFC might have better numbers, but there's $7.75 tariff price. $2 for the price of gas brings it to $9.75. We don't know the internal NSTAR or distribution cost. You thought at $2 might be a little high, so let's just say it's $1 for now. That's $10.75. Liquefaction maybe at $4, so that's $14.75. Tanker cost of roughly $1, $15.75. How easy is it going to be for – and then the ASAP study said they might be 30% off in their cost estimates on top of that. But how easy is it going to be for us to get long-term contracts at roughly $16 gas, do you think?
Well, Representative, if I knew that, I'd probably be in the gas business. A couple things, though. The figures you're looking at, figure 3.3 on page 310 in the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project Report, those are not in today's dollars. Those are a levelized tariff in dollars of the day over the 20 years of the pipeline life. So that assumes some inflation in there. It's possible that LNG prices in Asia also could inflate over time. So today's 14 or 15 or 12 or 13 would be higher over the next 20 years. And that's what marketing departments and companies gamble on. Alaska gas, whether it's to the U.S. market or to Asia, probably is always going to tend to be at the high side of the cost because we have an 800-mile pipeline, whether it goes to the Canadian border or the Arctic. An 800-mile pipeline, the tariff on it, puts it at a cost disadvantage with others. There's no question about it.
And Larry, just two other questions. One, given what we know about the reserves in Cook Inlet, the way this bill is written, we go ahead and the legislature doesn't get approval to stop the project. It just goes ahead unless they have to come back for legislative money. Given what we know about Cook Inlet reserves, do you think we have some time to see whether we can make a big pipeline that produces cheaper gas to work?
Okay, I'm not sure.
Let me say that again. Given what we know about the reserves in Cook Inlet, the sort of incomplete but fair information we know about the reserves in Cook Inlet, do you believe that we have time to use Cook Inlet gas and try and make a bigger pipeline that produces cheaper gas, a bigger pipeline to Asia or a bigger pipeline to the lower 48 work? Do we have time to try and see if we can put that together, or do you think we have to act right now in building and moving ahead with a small diameter pipeline?
Well, I represent Gary. As much as I'd like to speculate on the life expectancy and the exploration success in Cook Inlet, I'm really not qualified to do that. Certainly, everyone would like the biggest project possible to move the most gas because that will give the cheapest energy to Alaskans, and everyone would love to find a lot of gas in Cook Inlet, but I couldn't tell you how much is there, how long it's going to last. I'm hopeful, like everyone else, that exploration work in Cook Inlet will be successful, but I'll tell you who I think is going to win the World Series, and I'd probably be more qualified for that than guessing.
You're a Cubs fan, aren't you?
Just one last
question. I am, Mr. Chairman.
Just one last question. I was feeling bad for myself being a Red Sox fan, but I feel worse for you. The last question is, I've said this before, but it's just me, and I might be wrong. My understanding is if this line got built, this HV9 line got built, consumers would be obligated to pay for that price and that gas for a long period, because that's how pipeline projects work. The pipeline shipper won't build unless he has a long-term contract. Can you tell us how that works and what kind of length of contract might be required for Alaska consumers if a pipeline like this went forward?
Well, I guess not specifically, but I can tell you if I want to borrow money on a gas pipeline project or really any development, the lenders are going to want to know that I have a revenue stream for enough years to cover the mortgage. So if I build a pipeline, that's how you're going to get your best rates. And I'm sure the staff at AGDC would tell you the same. So if you're going to borrow money for 15 years, you've got to convince the lender you've got a 15-year revenue stream that's going to cover that mortgage. So it would depend how long your debt is for, would dictate to a great extent how long you're going to want your contracts for to use that pipe to produce the revenue to pay off the mortgage. But as many of us have learned with homes, you can stretch it out over a number of years, lower payments but higher interest costs, or you can accelerate it, pay it off in fewer years, stuff off the hook quicker. It's just going to come down to a financing decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Other questions for Mr. Pursley? Comment, over.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify for the record that nowhere in the document before us does it say there's a 24-inch pipeline or a 40-inch pipeline. And so when we start costing out numbers, they are speculation. We do have reports that point to some of the numbers, but we're asking a person that is not in our room to start making guesstimates that have many variables that would affect the economics. And inside of the document that's actually before us is a framework to try to pull projects together and cross a finish line for Alaska. It requires economics. It requires a safe construction, and it outlines many other things. But in all of the line of previous questions and the assertions that are made on the numbers of this project, none of that is in the bill before us. It is all a framework to be determined at a later time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other sponsor comments?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I concur completely with Representative Fairclough. This is Representative Mike Hawker, District 32, Anchorage.
Okay. Mr. Persay, thank you for waiting around, and I'm glad you got I know you're an Alaskan at heart, and you missed some of the things we talk about here. It is beautiful weather here as well, so.
We're not lying.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, I particularly miss House Finance.
Ooh. Thank you.
I mean that well.
Yes, I think that was a line.
Thank you for the time.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. And thank you, sir. Let's go to the, we still had amendments pending. We have an amendment number 13. Does everybody have that? just had it myself. Oh, there it is. Does everybody have the amendment? Representative Garrett, do you wish to move the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move amendment number 13.
I'll object.
Chair, the one of the sponsors, Representative Hawker, and his staff and I tried to reach a compromise on the issue of what happens if the RSA tries to make a decision in 180 days. The current bill says if they don't make the decision in 180 days, it's deemed to be approval. The question was, well, what happens if the utility doesn't provide information to the RCA and they can't make the decision in 180 days? I think we would all say this isn't language that either party wanted perfectly, but it sort of reaches a middle ground. And what it says is that if there is delay caused by the provision of information to the RCA, they don't have to make that decision in 180 days, and automatic approval doesn't come. You can't let a party sort of withhold information to try and beat that 180-day sort of deadline.
Mr. Hawker.
Mr. Chairman, if I might defer just for a brief, I concur, but we defer for a very brief response to my aide, Rena Delbridge.
Ms. Delbridge.
For the record, this is Rena Delbridge, staff to Representative Hawker. As Representative Garrett represented, we did reach a compromise on this and we're comfortable with this language.
I'll remove my objection. Is there any other objection? Hearing none, amendment number 13 is adopted. Are there any other amendments? Let's go to the fiscal notes. Mr. Dubler is here from the agency, and Representative Hawker, you're a pretty good hand at this as well. You want a tag team on there?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have done our, we've endeavored to do our best to provide this committee with the best possible resources.
Okay. Let's just go through fiscal notes. I think we just have one single fiscal note.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I would point the committee's attention to a fiscal note. It's dated 3/22/2012. It affects the Department of Revenue. It's an allocation to the Alaska Gas Development Corporation. The OMB component number is 2986. On it, you'll see a position count that varies. In FY13, it's 22.7 under the FY13 included in the governor's request. FY14, it's 45. FY15, it's 48. FY16, it's 61. FY17, it's 54, as well as in FY18. Total costs included in the governor's FY13 request is $3,629,400.
Any questions on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Representative Newman and Guerra.
Chair, I just, on the previous amendment, I'm looking at version K, and there is no line, I don't think the amendment is worded correctly, there is no commission on line 26, page 2.
We'll come back to that. We'll deal with the fiscal note right now. Representative
Guerra. Thank you, sir. Mr. Dubler, my understanding is that under this bill, if we pass it, your estimate is that it will cost roughly $400 million to get to project sanction. And am I correct about that?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Joe Dubler, Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And through the Chair, Representative Guerra, it would be $400 million is the total estimated cost for the pre-sanction activity. There's already been some costs incurred to date. I believe that the total cost incurred to date is somewhere in the range of $30 million. So it would be roughly $370 million additional funds.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, why is that not in the fiscal note, I guess?
Mr. Dubler.
I admit I can't find my fiscal notes at this point, and my file is just too fat.
Through the Chair, Representative Garrett, what is included in the fiscal note of the $286 million in capital costs on page 1? That's to get through FEL 2, which front-end loading stage 2, which would take us through an open season. At that point, we would come back for an additional appropriation to continue on in the event we had an open season. In the event we had a successful open season, we would come back to the legislature for appropriation for the third and final phase, which would be bringing us up to the sanction process, the decision to continue on with the project.
And through the chair, that would get us to the $400 million figure?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that's correct.
Question.
Representative Gettenberg.
Thank you. On page 2 in the bottom on the graph of the fiscal note, is that a typo of the first year? Should that be FY12? Or is that correct? 13.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, no, those are FY13. Those are intended to conform to the first page, where the second column is included in the governor's request of $3.6 million, and the first column of FY13 is the appropriation requested for this capital budget item.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Sure. Can I ask Mr. Dubler just to answer the questions that Mr. Persley didn't know so I can understand his cost estimates in this ASAP project plan? There were a couple components that Mr. Persley didn't know the answer to.
Related to the fiscal notes?
Well, it's related to the cost of the project.
Let's take a brief at ease. Back to order, and we're on the fiscal notes. Any other questions on the fiscal notes? Okay, we will move on. Let's go to the, is there a motion to move the bill out of committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and make the motion.
Mr. Chairman, could I clarify the record? Mr. Representative Newman was asking about the amendment. The amendment is specific to the previous amendment, and that's the page number that it's on. So amendment number 3 that was offered last night, if you look there on page 2, line 26, that's where you see the word commission. And so since we have multiple amendments that are out there, this is an amendment, and the placement there is for amendment number 13 that's been accepted is on amendment number 3 for the placement. So our drafters will need to clarify that to insert.
Yep. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I move from committee the CS for House Bill number 9, Finance, as amended, with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Are there any objections?
I do object.
Objection. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Mr. Dubler just to fill in a couple numbers that were missing from this cost estimate?
Mr. Dubler, Representative Guerra, and we will you can respond accordingly.
Mr. Dubler, on page 310 of the ASAP project plan, where I know that your better scenario, the more preferable scenario under your project, is the 500 MCF line. And in figure 3.3, this one assumes that you export 250 MCF from possibly Nikiski. And so you show a tariff to Big Lake at $7.75. You're shaking your head now.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, for the record, Joe Dubler from AGDC. The 3-3 is estimated tariff for the base case, which is 500 MCF, but it's using inflated dollars. That's what Mr. Persley attempted to say in his testimony. So those are actually inflated dollars at 775. The base case at nominal dollars or current dollars is included in 3-4, and that's the 563 tariff. So, and that's what Larry was attempting, or Mr. Persley was attempting to say, was that 775 is a future dollar number, and that it, to compare that with current dollars is not appropriate.
Just to understand through the chair, future dollars are what this would cost in the future at the time we're possibly delivering the gas?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that's correct, at a 3% per year inflation rate.
Okay. All right, so regardless of the numbers I'm missing are, you're assuming on top of these numbers a $2 cost for gas, right? And then for distribution from Big Lake down to Tidewater, what's your estimate as to the cost for that?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, I think all we assume is the gas to Big Lake, and that the liquefaction process would or the liquefaction producer would bring the gas from Dunbar or from Big Lake to their facility.
Okay.
So it's included in what we assumed would cost in the liquefaction process.
And then so just the from Big Lake to Tidewater between liquefaction and transportation, what's the additional increment that would be added?
And I think, I'd like to get this bill out of committee. We keep treading over a lot of the same stuff. Would you spend some time with Representative Garrett in his office?
Certainly, Representative Sultan. And if I could, I'd like to sit in your office and we can get Daryl, our commercial manager, on the phone. He's the one who's the expert on these numbers.
Okay. That's fine.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hate to go backward, but I'm looking at the fiscal note here. Sure. And it says, I'm sorry, down at the sort of after all that stuff where it starts, where it says estimated capital cost FY13, it gives a $286 million and change figure there. Is that the total cost? It's this plus the $200 million that's already been appropriated. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, no, that this would be the expenditure of that $200 million plus some additional expenditures that the different departments had put in for working on this project, for instance, DEC, DNR, DOT, the different departments.
Mr. Chairman, can you help me here? I thought I heard a $400 million number referenced at some point.
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, $400 million is the total amount of capital expenditures that we're estimating will be required to be spent up until the sanction process. This 286 is a part of that $400 million.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, just one more. So the total cost would be this plus whatever the balance to make it $400 million. That's what it would be.
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, that is correct, except for one correction, less the amount that's already been expended, because that's included in the $400.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, as much as I love dealing with this bill, and I'd like to spend a couple more weeks on it, Representative Wilson, I'm not trying to rush anybody.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to prolong, but I kind of was confused last night, so I just want to verify before this happens, and I think I have it straight now, but I think I put some misinformation in my own community, so I want to make sure that they realize how this is. So for right now, what this does as far as costs and tariffs go, the line from the North Slope to Dunbar, everybody throughout the state who will be using this gas, that's how it will be divided. And then from Dunbar to Fairbanks, plus if a straddle plant is needed, would be by the users of Fairbanks. And from Dunbar down to wherever it ends at Anchorage, plus if a straddle plant, would be done by Anchorage. And so if that is true, which I'm nodding their heads, yes, so I feel good that I'm finally grasping this. But the cost analysis that we have right now is that basically Anchorage would be paying around, and all this, these figures can change as the pipe goes, which is from what we have now. Anchorage would be paying a tariff of $9.63. Fairbanks would be paying $10.45, which is a difference of 82 cents per million BTUs. And currently, we are paying in Fairbanks $23.35 versus $10.45. So ultimately, it would be a 55% decrease from what we're paying for gas. And the more that we get off on heating oil would be actually a 66% decrease. Do I finally have it correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, you do. And I might just add, Anchorage would have a less than a 10% increase in their cost of gas. And this project would supply gas to Fairbanks and Anchorage for an indefinite amount of time with the amount of gas that's proven on the slope.
Mr. Chair, I thank you for giving us this time. I had some timing with Mr. Walker yesterday, and now I know, you know, with the issue and those other things, where he stands. And for my community, we're getting this information slowly out to them. It's going to take some time, but this is not necessarily perfect, but we have got to keep the framework going and keep working out the figures. And for that, I am in support of this, but we are in Fairbanks going to be watching closely to make sure that these figures really do bring affordable gas. And I really thank you for everything and the time you've taken for me to understand this.
Okay. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that because of my health problems, I wasn't here for last night's session, and I intend to offer at least one amendment on the floor. So I just wanted everybody to know that. Thank you.
Only one?
I said at least.
Okay, let's go ahead and call the roll on the motion.
Representative Fairclough?
Yes.
Representative Guerra?
No.
Representative Guttenberg?
No.
Representative Jewell?
Yes.
Representative Newman?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Costello?
Yes.
Representative Dugan?
Yes.
Representative Edgman?
Yes.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Thomas?
Yes.
9 yay, 2 nay.
So the bill is moved out of committee. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I sat through this, you know, days, weeks. Not once was it mentioned beyond Fairbanks, going down to Haines, going, we can truck. And the opportunity for us to truck even to Atok or Delta, elsewhere, was never even pointed out. And I'm going to vote for this thing, but I think people got to realize there's more to Alaska than Anchorage, Fairbanks, Mat-Su, down the Yukon River. I mean, this is going to branch out, and not once was it ever said that we can move this elsewhere. And I'm just, you know, I'm going to support it, but I've had to bite my tongue till the end. But I am here.
Mr. Chairman, I did ring that up.
I know we want to get out of here, but very quickly, I would like to assure Representative Thomas that had those questions been asked, we were absolutely prepared to respond and discuss this as sponsors of the bill. And a significant part and a significant focus of this bill is that it's all about getting a backbone established, a backbone that provides a way to get the majority of gas from the North Slope reserves to Tidewater and South Central. We specifically empower AGDC in this to view any other way they can bring gas and work to provide access to gas for those communities that they might be able to reach on a economically feasible basis. That very much includes the propane project down the Yukon River that ANGDA has worked on and preserved. And likewise, I would offer as a legislator, it is then up to us to look at vision for future development, as has been discussed possibly, of creating, looking at a Norway model of a fleet of compressed natural gas tankers that could work off of Tidewater and provide coastal deliveries all around the state of Alaska. The only limitation to what we can serve in Alaska is limited only by our own vision once we get a backbone established. And the co-chairman has my absolute commitment to share that vision with him. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I just want to make a quick statement, if I could.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, in response to what Representative Thomas was saying and the bill sponsor replying, I very much share the comments from Representative Thomas, but I also, to the bill sponsor's credit, want to thank him for coming back with some intent language in the front section of the bill that sort of further clarified that this application of this could definitely very well be statewide in nature. And that I'll close by saying that to me, like I've said so many times before, renewable energy this, renewable energy that, this, whatever it might be, that natural gas is going to be the great equalizer in the state in terms of bringing affordable energy to all areas of the state. Thank you.
With deep appreciation for the many hours members of this committee, staff, our clerical and support staff have spent as we've gone through some, this is a little tune-up for later in the session, unfortunately. thank you to everybody in appreciation of that. We are going to cancel the 1:30 meeting today. So thank you, and we'll see everybody on the floor. We'll come back Monday morning.